there was a rapid development of plantations and proprietary colonies. Lord Baltimore had already, in 1632, set up a colony that was to be a home of religious freedom for Catholics, under the attractive name of Maryland, to the north and east of Virginia. And now the Quaker, Penn, whose father had rendered valuable services to Charles II, established himself to the north at Philadelphia and founded the colony of Pennsylvania. Its main boundary with Maryland and Virginia was delimited by two men, Mason and Dixon, whose Mason and Dixon's line was destined to become a very important line indeed in the later affairs of the United States. Carolina, which was originally an unsuccessful French Protestant establishment, and which owed its name not to Charles Carolus II of England, but to Charles IX of France, had fallen into English hands and was settled at several points. Between Maryland and New England stretched a number of small Dutch and Swedish settlements, of which the chief town was New Amsterdam. These settlements were captured from the Dutch by the British in 1664, lost again in 1673, and restored by treaty when Holland and England made peace in 1674. Thereby the whole coast, from Maine to Carolina, became in some form or other a British possession. To the south, the Spanish were established. Their headquarters were at Fort St. Augustine in Florida, and in 1732 the town of Savannah was settled by a philanthropist, Oglethorpe, from England, who had taken pity on the miserable people imprisoned for debt in England, and rescued a number of them from prison to become the founders of a new colony, Georgia, which was to be a bulwark against the Spanish. So, by the middle of the 18th century, we have these settlements along the American coastline. The New England group of Puritans and Free Protestants, Maine, belonging to Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, the captured Dutch group, which was now divided up into New York, New Amsterdam, rechristened, New Jersey, and Delaware, Swedish before it was Dutch, and in its earliest British phase attached to Pennsylvania. Then came Catholic Maryland, Cavalier Virginia, Carolina, which was presently divided into North and South, and Oglethorpe's Georgia. Later on, a number of Tyrolese Protestants took refuge in Georgia, and there was a considerable immigration of a good class of German cultivators into Pennsylvania. Such were the miscellaneous origins of the citizens of the 13 colonies. The possibility of their ever becoming closely united would have struck an impartial observer in 1760 as being very slight. Superadded to the initial differences of origin, fresh differences were created by climate. North of the Mason and Dixon line, farming was practiced mainly upon British or Central European lines by free white cultivators. The settled country of New England took on a likeness to the English countryside. Considerable areas of Pennsylvania developed fields and farmhouses like those of South Germany. The distinctive conditions in the North had socially important effects. Masters and men had to labour together as backwoodsmen and were equalised in the process. They didn't start equally. Many servants are mentioned in the roster of the Mayflower. But they rapidly became equal under colonial conditions. There was, for instance, a vast tract of land to be had for the taking, and the servant went off and took land like his master. The English class system disappeared. Under colonial conditions there arose equality in the faculties both of body and mind, and an individual independence of judgment impatient of interference from England. But south of the Mason and Dixon line, tobacco growing began, and the warmer climate encouraged the establishment of plantations with gang labor. Red Indian captives were tried, but found to be too homicidal. Cromwell sent Irish prisoners of war to Virginia, which did much to reconcile the royalist planters to republicanism. Convicts were sent out, and there was a considerable trade in kidnapped children who were spirited away to America to become apprentices or bond slaves. But the most convenient form of gang labor proved to be that of Negro slaves. The first Negro slaves were brought to Jamestown in Virginia by a Dutch ship as early as 1620. By 1700, Negro slaves were scattered all over the states, but Virginia, Maryland, and the Carolinas were their chief regions of employment, and while the communities to the north were communities of not very rich and not very poor farming men, the South developed a type of large proprietor and a white community of overseers and professional men subsisting on slave labor. Slave labor was a necessity to the social and economic system that had grown up in the South. In the North, the presence of slaves was unnecessary and in some respects inconvenient. Conscientious scruples about slavery were more free, therefore, to develop and flourish in the northern atmosphere. To this question of the revival of slavery in the world, we must return when we come to consider the perplexities of American democracy. Here we note it simply as an added factor in the heterogeneous mixture of the British colonies. But if the inhabitants of the 13 colonies were miscellaneous in their origins and various in their habits and sympathies, they had three very strong antagonisms in common. They had a common interest against the Red Indians. For a time, they shared a common dread of French conquest and dominion. And thirdly, they were all in conflict with the claims of the British Crown and the commercial selfishness of the narrow oligarchy who dominated the British Parliament and British affairs. So far as the first danger went, the Indians were a constant evil, but never more than a threat of disaster. They remained divided against themselves. Yet they had shown possibilities of combination upon a larger scale. The Five Nations of the Iroquois was a very important league of tribes, but it never succeeded in playing off the French against the English to secure itself, and no Red Indian Genghis Khan ever arose among these nomads of the New World. The French aggression was a more serious threat. The French never made settlements in America on a scale to compete with the English, but their government set about the encirclement of the colonies and their subjugation in a terrifyingly systematic manner. The English in America were colonists, the French were explorers, adventurers, agents, missionaries, merchants, and soldiers. Only in Canada did they strike root. French statesmen sat over maps and dreamt dreams, and their dreams are to be seen in our map in the chain of forts, creeping southward from the Great Lakes and northward up the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. The struggle of France and Britain was a worldwide struggle. It was decided in India, in Germany, and on the high seas. In the Peace of Paris in 1763, the French gave England Canada and relinquished Louisiana to the inert hands of declining Spain. It was the complete abandonment of America by France. The lifting of the French danger left the colonists unencumbered to face their third common antagonist, the crown and government of their motherland. Third, we've noted in the previous chapter how the governing class of Great Britain steadily acquired the land and destroyed the liberty of the common people throughout the 18th century, and how greedily and blindly the new Industrial Revolution was brought about. We've noted also how the British Parliament, through the decay of the representative methods of the House of Commons, had become both in its upper and lower houses merely the instrument of government through the big landowners. Both these big property holders and the Crown were deeply interested in America. the former as private adventurers, the latter partly as representing the speculative exploitations of the Stuart kings, and partly as representing the state in search of funds for the expenses of foreign policy.